Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode number 359. Today we're looking at the questions taken from Guide 428 to the Kirov class cruisers of the Soviet Union, and the Wednesday video on Admiral Spruance from the Battle of Okinawa to his final days. So let's start with questions. Firestorm 33 asks, if the US Navy had gotten Congress to actually stop penny pinching during World War I, would there and could there have been possible designs for new construction cruisers drawn up? Well, just because the US wasn't given the money to build new cruisers didn't mean they didn't continue looking into what they might build if they were given the money. So we do actually have quite a range of surviving designs. Everything from this wonderful number, which is one of a large number of different designs drawn up for a scout cruiser proposal in the mid-1910s. This is part of a subset which I call the Jackie Fisher Eat Your Heart Out section. Because, well, they're essentially American versions of the Courageous class. Very fractionally, theoretically, possibly slower, but usually far more heavily armed. Some of them have two twin 14-inch. This one has two twin 16-inch. And there's one or two that are essentially pocket battle cruisers as well. They're not really cruisers at that point. But anyway, so yeah, if you like the definition large light cruiser, here's one of the US versions. And then you've got this thing, which, depending on how charitable you're trying to be, is either reinventing the armored cruiser concept in as much as got a single 8-inch gun fore, single 8-inch gun aft. As you can see, relatively minimal protection, so not really an armored cruiser because this is supposed to be a scout cruiser, but it's the old school armored cruiser gun layout. You know, two heavy guns, one fore, one aft, bunch of smaller guns amidships. Alternatively, if you're being more charitable, you could say this is kind of following the trend that the later World War I Town class and early C class had set in moving protected cruiser armament up from just essentially destroyer grade guns, you know, 4-inch or 5-inch in the US case, to having a 6-inch gun, fore and aft, and then a bunch of four, in the British case, 4-inch guns amidships. And then they moved on to all 6-inch armament, and this is kind of taking it the next logical step, in theory at least, where you have, you know, a couple of 8-inch guns and majority 5-inch armament. So that's one alternative for a scout cruiser. But if you don't like that, then there's this kind of scout cruiser. This is a little bit slower, not quite 30 knots, but it has a whole bunch of 6-inch guns and some torpedo launchers amidships, and actually has relatively extensive, if somewhat thin, belt armor. These are all single guns. The US really does like its single guns at this point. Well, to be fair, most people are building their cruisers with single guns at this stage as well. However, bearing this is 1915, most navies are going for kind of, if you're going to have wing guns, have them amidships, fore and aft guns should be centerline. Whereas as you can see here, you do have centerline guns aft, but there's a whole battery of port and starboard wing guns right up front. And then at the extreme end, we have the start of the US obsession with 35 knots as a scout speed. This is supposed to be a 35 knot scout cruiser. As you can see, it's pretty much a hull, a very, very minimal superstructure, and 10 6-inch guns. And yes, if you count along, there are, you can only see six and then one super, so, well, not super firing, one center line up top. But some of these are going to be wing mounts. So, for example, the one that you can see next to the bridge, below the one that's just in front of the bridge, that's going to be a wing mount. I suspect the one behind the funnel is also a wing mount, and maybe the one just ahead of the bridge is also a wing mount, so that would bring you up to your requisite 10. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, had the Soviet Navy been more successful in their initial naval building attempts during the interwar period, how would that have affected the London Naval Treaty? I guess it depends on how much you define success and when do you look at your initial naval building attempts. So, for example, maximal success would be they decide that being able to construct ships is not a bourgeoisie concept, and therefore they don't try and execute most of the ship designers. And somehow they magic up the cash to complete the Borodino-class battlecruisers, or Ismail-class, hull of which you can see here. Now, if they're able to bring those to the table, obviously, that's going to be postdating the Washington Treaty, but if that's their basis and then they go on to continue expanding the fleet in the 20s, when historically they didn't try much of anything, then they might start looking at bringing the Soviets in to the London Naval Treaty in the 1931 specifically, if they can persuade the Soviets to actually sign up to the idea. If, however, we're talking about the historical initial purge and pause in shipbuilding, and then we're just talking about when they restart in mostly the 1930s, trying to rebuild their fleet, but this now goes somewhat more successfully, that's actually going to be too late even for the 1930 London Naval Treaty, which means that if they're going to be brought in on anything, it'll be the second London Naval Treaty in the mid-1930s, which, as we know, probably doesn't really affect all that much because that treaty is going to collapse very, very quickly. We know that in hindsight. But at the time, to be honest, I think even with the most plausible successful Soviet naval rearmament process, I don't think the treaty powers are going to be that nervous. They'd only start to be nervous if things like trying to build the Svetsky Soyuz actually went on time and in the numbers that were originally envisaged, which is a little bit out there in terms of reality. In any vaguely plausible naval rearmament effort, the treaty powers are going to be looking at, and apart from anything else, going, well, yeah, but the Soviets have three completely separate fleets, possibly later on with the Northern Fleet 4, to try and stock, and they can't really support each other, which means that whatever they do manage to build, any one treaty power only really has to concern itself with facing off against one third of that. I mean, you look at some of the cruisers they did manage to build. You build a class of six, fantastic. Unfortunately, two are in the Baltic, two are in the Black Sea, and two are in the Pacific. So as far as the treaty powers are concerned, the Royal Navy probably only really has to worry about the two in the Baltic. The Turks are pretty much the only ones who have to worry about the ones in the Black Sea, although I suppose France, Italy, or Britain could worry about those two getting into the Mediterranean, and the Japanese are the only ones who are going to care about the ones in the Pacific. At which point those forces individually don't really add up to all that much. Iron Blood Enjoyer asks, what would a Kirov class have looked like if it was built by another navy, say the Imperial Japanese Navy, the Royal Navy, the Kriegsmarine, etc.? Well, if you're looking at the Kirovs and you're looking at, well, around 8,000 tons, give or take, and with ambitions to be kind of heavy cruiser punching weight, but not quite a full heavy cruiser. Well, for the British, we actually know exactly what that would look like. That's the York class, essentially. An attempt at a pocket county class. Not a massively successful attempt, but an attempt nonetheless. And, well, to be perfectly honest, I'd still take a York class over a Kirov, because, I might hit the broadside of a barn occasionally. Now, for the Japanese, tonnage-wise, you're looking at something like an Alba class. However, of course, the Albas are, a decade or more older than the Kirovs, so it is perhaps a little bit of an unfair comparison. The thing is, the Japanese didn't build anything vaguely similar in the time period. However, there is a potential, well, not necessarily a class you can point out and say this is what it would have been like, but there is a potential class you could have used as a basis for a sub 10,000 ton sort of pocket heavy cruiser. At which point I would probably say, okay, take the Oyodo class, which has two 666 up front and then a whole hangar and a bunch of aircraft aft, and pretty much like they did with the Megamis, you swap out the front 666 for twin 8s, and then you dispense with the hangar and the aircraft facilities aft, apart from maybe just a couple of stern-mounted aircraft, and then you could put another twin 8 roughly where the hangar was, improve your AA capabilities, etc., etc. That would give you something that is kind of a reasonable Alba successor dash also Kirov equivalent. And to be honest, on the size of the Oyodo hull, you could probably fit a few other bits and pieces there as well. It's quite a large hull, all things considered. For the Kriegsmarine, well, there's nothing really in that vicinity, because you've got the Deutschlands, but the Deutschlands are a couple of thousand tons heavier at the very minimum. You could perhaps look at the M-class cruisers that the Kriegsmarine were planning for Plan Z. I mean, they're 8,500 tons, high speed. Now, as designed, they're armed with four twin 5.9-inch, but I'm pretty sure with a slight bit of redesign, you could probably, again, get three twin 8-inch on there. Although, you know, this being a German design, it'll probably be ostensibly designed for 8,500 tons as a pocket heavy cruiser. And given what the Hippers came out with, it'll probably come out at like 11,000 tons or something like that. Nicolas Santiago asks, why does nobody call the Kirov class heavy cruisers? Most places I see them being referred to as simply cruisers and sometimes even light cruisers. But as far as I understand, heavy cruisers are cruisers that are cruisers armed with guns bigger than 6 inches. So why do historians resist calling them heavy cruisers? Personally, although you are absolutely correct in that, certainly by the treaty terms, anything with a gun above 6 inch is going to be a heavy cruiser, I think a lot of historians are reticent to call the Kirovs heavy cruisers simply because if you did, they'd immediately slot in as the single worst heavy cruisers of all time by a long margin. Literally the only thing they have going for them, if you put them in as heavy cruisers, is their speed. Yeah, they can go a fair old clip, fine. But other than that, well, they're 777.1-inch gun mounts have a litany of issues, which, you know, we've gone over at length in the Kirov class video. And, well, their protection is such it makes a Pensacola look like a heavily armoured fortress. And, well, yeah, that's, you've got good speed, but your protection is abysmal, your firepower is worse, and at that point, given that, but admittedly, yes, it's all being done on less than 8,000 ton standard, but still, you know, put them up against even an Alba or a Hawkins or a York or any one of those, you know, well, we've reclassified them as heavy cruisers, but, you know, kind of start of the interwar period stuff. And yeah, assuming equal fire control, those old ships are still going to stand a better than 50-50 chance of dealing with a Kirov. Whereas if you put them in light cruiser territory, some light cruisers are of similar speed, many light cruisers are of similarly poor protection. It, well, depends on which light cruiser you're looking at, but there's a fair number of them which are going to share a similar grade of armour. And, well, the once every glacial epoch the guns are able to fire, their overall broadside firepower and armor penetration isn't that dissimilar to the kind of stuff you'd get off of a 12 or 15 gun 6-inch ship in overall terms. So, yeah, although by letter of the law they are heavy cruisers, they actually fit more in the light cruiser category. Warrant Officer Will asks, in a previous Patreon dry dock, you mentioned that it was perfectly feasible for the US's interwar airships, had they still been around, to have been converted into proto-AWACS platforms. Had this been the case, how useful would the airships have been in World War II? And what events would the deployment of radar-equipped airships have changed? Well, obviously they would need a bit of work to, you know, be effective in World War II. They had a few structural issues and such like that probably contributed to their losses. But assuming that they're overhauled in the mid to late 1930s and that they've survived that long, my ideal refit for them would be to keep their capacity at three. They were obviously working to actually fully open up the hangar so they could take five aircraft. But I would actually just keep the three because you're going to need the weight for radar and the operators and so on and so forth. Now, what I would do is I would actually stick probably in the aft hangar section, or just sticking out of the aft hangar section, I would deploy several sets of ASV radar because it's actually pretty light stuff. So, you know, have them arranged, you know, depending on what arc they can cover, whether you need three or four of them, but basically have them arranged to provide you with 360 coverage. And then for an air-to-air radar, you could either stick one on the gondola or maybe stick one in the nose and one in the tail or something like that. And essentially have a little airborne command and control center. And if that means you have to take off a bunch of the machine gun defensive emplacements, then so be it, because ultimately you're extremely unlikely to need them. And if you do need air-to-air defense, that's what the fighters are for. So my idea then would be a mixture of air-to-air and air-to-ground or air-to-surface radar, because you would then use it as a convoy escort. So it'd fly above the convoy. Now, obviously, in some weather conditions in the Atlantic, you can't do that, but there are plenty of convoys where the weather is relatively good. And then you use your ASV radar to spot submarines on and periscopes on the surface, and from your position nice and high up, you can then either direct convoy escorts to go after the sub, or if it's a very quick reaction that you need, you can deploy one of the aircraft, one of your little fighters, and maybe load it with a basic bomb. You don't need that much to damage a U-boat enough to keep it on the surface. And you can send it out, and the fighter might even work as a kind of, well, you know, you're giving directions to the convoy escort, but if you send a fighter out as well, the fighter can circle at high altitude, keep an eye on it, and then kind of dive, kind of point, this is where you need to go. Although, of course, you do run the risk of identifying to the U-boat that they have been spotted. So you need to take that on balance. And then with your air-to-air radar, you can obviously keep a good lookout for incoming Condors and other German patrol aircraft as you get closer to the eastern side of the Atlantic. And if one of them does happen to come a-calling, well, send a couple of fighters out and shoot it down. That would be my solution, because ultimately, yeah, you've only got three fighters, but the Germans don't have many Condors. So if you can, even if you've only got a 1 in 2 or 1 in 3 interception success rate, the Germans will run out of Condors very, very fast. And they can't really send a Condor after the airship, because if they do, well, then you send all three fighters out and it's going to lose long before it can do fatal damage to your airship. So between essentially an eye in the sky warding off the U-boats, as well as, you know, keeping the Condors away from you, then you would dramatically reduce convoy losses. Now, obviously, you've only got the two, so you'd probably only be running one at a time, and sometimes none would be available. And in winter months, there probably would be sections of weather where it's not going to be suitable for these ships, airships to fly. But anything helps, and the amount of help that they do offer would, I think, be quite dramatic. Obviously, don't go too near East Western Europe, because you might get actually shot down by Ju-88s or something, but that's what other types of convoy escort are for. Imprison Grover Fur asks, would it have been possible for Tirpitz, Scharnhorst, and the other remaining German cruisers to do a Bering Strait dash during the sea ice nadir in the boreal summer of 1944? Was there any chance of them being successful? And if they were, how would this affect the war? It's certainly physically possible to do. The Arctic was going through a bit of a warm period in the 40s, and various ships had made the transit before the Soviet Union and the Germans were at war. One of the Hilfskreuzer had gone that way. And after they were at war, the Russians had tried to bring supplies that way, although the Kriegsmarine had actually managed to destroy quite a number of those ships. The main problems you would face is that the warships can't go it alone, unless you really like having your bow smashed up by ice. When the Hilfskreuzer went round, it was escorted by icebreakers. Soviet icebreakers. Now, the Germans do have icebreakers, but not that many. And I don't know if they've got any that are long range and heavy duty enough to actually forge through whatever ice there was in summer 1943. But assuming that they're willing to send an icebreaker out as well, and it's got the capacity to do the job, then yes, physically it's possible to transit the Kriegsmarine ships up there. You probably have to send a couple of tankers for refueling as well. It is a bit of a trek. The big problem is going to be, well, one, it's going to be a slow going. You know, even if you have an icebreaker and tankers and all of this, you ain't going through this pack ice very quickly. And that means the Soviet Air Force is just going to be hitting you and hitting you and hitting you and hitting you, and you ain't having any Luftwaffe air cover for the most part of it. I mean, you'll be traveling at a speed such that, you know, a wing of Soviet bombers could potentially attack you and RTB, but RTB further east, to an area where somebody, presumably having gone on the Trans-Siberian Railway or something like that, has set up a new scratch airfield for them and hit you again. And yeah, it would not be a fun experience, but let's assume that you've got the icebreakers, you've got the fuel, you've got the tankers, you're willing to basically write them all off because you ain't getting them back, and that the Soviet Air Force somehow misses you, or, you know, either misses your sailing or misses you literally and, you know, doesn't score any hits or whatever. Let's assume all of that and they do somehow make it down through the Bering Strait and into the Pacific. Well, in 1943, unfortunately, that's not really going to do a whole lot, because what you've essentially gifted the Japanese with at that point is, yeah, you've got a couple more heavy cruisers, a couple more fast battleships, but it's 1943 and the Americans are coming with a lot of Essexes and Independences, and the Japanese don't have that much fuel. So I don't think it's going to help all that much, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there aren't any big surface engagements that historically happened that they could augment in 1943. You could potentially argue that when it comes to the Battle of Leyte Gulf, you might stick Tirpitz and Scharnhorst and the German cruisers and anything else that made it through with center force and have an even bigger force under Kurita trying to punch through. But, you know, you're asking a lot for all of those ships to still be intact and operational by that stage of the war. I think ultimately what would be of the most benefit would probably be all the radar suites and other advanced technological paraphernalia that would be present on the ships that the Japanese could then adapt and copy. And I suppose it would take a maintenance bill off the Kriegsmarine, but it would essentially remove the heavy surface threat from the Northern European War. And 1943, with the Italians bowing out as well, to be honest, if anything, it would actually do the Allies a favour, because if the Germans now have nothing bigger than a Königsberg in Europe and the Italians are out of play, then essentially that means every single British and American battleship and aircraft carrier, and probably a good chunk of the heavy cruisers, they can go to the Pacific a lot earlier than historically they did. Nikujaga Oishi asks, as opposed to some politically savvy but less tactically proficient admirals who often become a subject of criticism, were there any notable examples of admirals who were perfectly competent during their commands at sea but didn't perform quite effectively at the top level? For example, as part of a senior naval leadership, such as being the first Sea Lord, they might be less than ideal at navigating the political landscape during peacetime, but be very good at commanding fleets at sea during wartime. Nelson would be a classic example of this. He's an absolutely brilliant commander while at sea, but put him on land in almost any role and he's terrible, basically. You know, he tries to play general in Italy. That really doesn't work out. His personal love affairs obviously, you know, cost him an awful lot of the social cachet he builds up by winning various battles. He is briefly a parliamentarian, not a particularly good one, to be perfectly honest. So, yeah, in many, 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 many ways, Nelson did himself a favour by dying at Trafalgar, because he died at the absolute pinnacle of his career. There wasn't going to be another big fleet action against the Franco-Spanish navies after that, which meant that essentially all he could do is spend increasing amounts of time ashore, gradually whittling down the, you know, the glory that he'd won out at sea. And someone who's sometimes described as the Nelson of the East, or maybe Nelson is the Yi Sun Shin of the West, Admiral Yi Sun Shin, again, absolutely superb commander at sea, turned out to be very easy to politically outmaneuver, which, to be fair, the people who politically outmaneuvered him, they kind of paid for it with colossal failures when he wasn't in command at sea anymore. I would perhaps also put Admiral Charles Beresford in that category, Fisher's great rival in the 1900s. Beresford to be fair, was a very competent admiral at sea. He, you know, he was initially quite au fait with advancing technology. He had pretty good formations, discipline, bit of initiative in his fleet, etc. But it seemed as he went higher and higher up the chain of command, he seemed to get more and more, what's the best way of putting it, more and more dictatorial. And essentially a lot of the things that made him a really good flag officer at the lower levels seemed to disappear. And he also became somewhat more recalcitrant about most advanced technology, which was, again, a bit of a turnaround for him. So exactly what, why that was, I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, it was probably just as well for the Royal Navy that he retired before the First World War, because I don't think he would have done very well in the higher echelons of the Navy during the war. And I'd potentially, as you put Admiral Raeder, head of the Kriegsmarine, up there as well. Now, to be fair, Raeder was playing World War II navies on hard mode, being in charge of the Kriegsmarine. But although he seems to have had a reasonably decent career, certainly in the First World War, I wouldn't necessarily say his decision-making at the, as head of the Kriegsmarine was coherent, really, because you have things like, at the beginning of the war, Captain Langsdorff scuttles the Graf Spee to preserve his crew against a helpless fight. So Raeder's like, oh no, this isn't in keeping with the honour of the German Navy. We have to be far more aggressive. Then Admiral Marschall takes Scharnhorst and Gneisenau up against Glorious against orders and wins one of the Kriegsmarine's greatest surface victories and is sacked for being too aggressive. And it's like, well, what do you want? Do you want them to be aggressive? Do you want them to be passive? You can't have both and punish both at the same time. And I think, at least to me, Raeder seemed a little bit too sensitive to political winds. You know, yeah, Rheinabung, for all the controversy that causes, realistically, when he was confronted with the idea of, well, we could send, okay, Gneisenau has been bombed, but we could send Scharnhorst, Tirpitz and Bismarck together with Prince Eugen and maybe one or two other cruisers, but we can't go right now because Scharnhorst needs repairs and Tirpitz isn't fully worked up. Realistically, you should turn around and say, look, for the good of the Navy and for the good of the nation, we need to wait till everything's ready, a few months. But instead, there's political pressure surrounding Barbarossa and everything, and he sends Bismarck and Prinz Eugen out, and, well, Bismarck never comes back. So, again, admittedly, he is playing hard mode, and he does have a lot of pressure from up top to do things, but the way Kriegsmarine High Command orders facilitate back and forth over whether you should be aggressive, whether you should not even engage an equal force, and some of the tactical and strategic plans that the Kriegsmarine comes up with, especially once the initial successes of, you know, Norway and so forth have passed, it doesn't seem to me like he was doing a particularly brilliant job of things. BK Zhong asks, what do you think is the single dumbest Navy-related decision made by anyone in the chain of command in the period that the channel covers? I would actually, I'm going to put two British admirals in the firing line here. One of them you probably expect, the other one maybe not. Because there's a lot of really, really dumb decisions made by various officers in various navies at various times. But I think the two that I'm about to nominate, I think to me they always stand out when someone says who did something really dumb, because in both cases there are multiple reasons why it's dumb. You know, sometimes a decision is dumb just because there's a really big obvious reason. In these two cases there are multiple problems. So one is at the Battle of Toulon, or one of the many battles of Toulon, the one that are depicted here, you have Admiral Matthews and a young captain, Edward Hawke. Yeah, I wonder what he's going to do in the future. Anyway, Hawke and Matthews, obviously Matthews being in charge of the fleet, they're facing against an enemy fleet, mostly Spanish to start with. The French will show up to help out later on. That's helped the Spanish out. Now, at the time, signals weren't particularly clear. It wasn't like the signal books that Nelson would have available to him later on. But They are at war. There's a hostile fleet present. Matthews signals to go into the attack and takes his flagship and the nearby ships into attack. Admiral Lestock, who's commanding the rear portion of the British fleet, doesn't particularly like Matthews and just decides to essentially sit the whole thing out, which then leaves Matthews and Hawke and a couple of others exceptionally heavily outnumbered. And if not for the fact that the Spanish fleet wasn't particularly well handled, and the French fleet seemed mostly concerned with helping the Spanish, you know, get away and sort themselves out rather more so than attacking the British, the Battle of Toulon could have been an absolute disaster. And, you know, yeah, okay, Lestock, you don't like Matthews, but this is a battle, you know. If Matthews has hoisted his flag and has led his section of the fleet into attack, there aren't, I mean, he, thanks to political friends, he manages to get away with it, but from an objective perspective, there aren't any excuses for not engaging in the attack, regardless of what you do or don't think about your superior officer. At that point, a significant chunk of the nation's fleet has been committed to this action. If you don't support them, well, one, who do you think they're coming for next once they finish off Matthew's section of the fleet? Self-preservation dictates you should be helping out. Secondly, the honour of the nation and the strategic position of the nation would suffer very greatly if realistically what should have happened and Matthew's forces cut off and annihilated. And thirdly, if it is really that decisive, you are really going to be in for it. So, you know, from a professional perspective, from a personal perspective, from a self-aggrandizing perspective, and from a national patriotic perspective, you absolutely should engage. Unless it's like, nope, don't like him, I'm going to sit it out and watch. And he is exceptionally lucky that Matthews, Hawke, and their compatriots manage to fight as hard as they do and eventually mostly extricate themselves from the situation. There aren't that many cases where you could potentially have doomed an entire nation's fleet and strategic purpose just out of petty personal jealousy, but Lestock very nearly managed it. Literally, it would have been better for everyone if Lestock had been shoved over the side and into the sea at the beginning of that engagement. The other one is an admiral you've probably all expected me to say, which is Beatty, but not for Jutland. The dumb Navy-related decision that I think Beatty made that really, really eclipses them all is later on in the war, when he's Admiral of the Grand Fleet, and he splits the fleet in two, and Admiral Sturdy takes command of the other half, and it's a war game, you know, to simulate various manoeuvres, who's going to do better, etc., etc. Fog descends, okay, so reduced visibility. It's a little bit thicker than it was at Jutland, but you know, it's the North Sea, you might have to fight in reduced visibility. Beatty, instead of actually trying anything, essentially just has a mini meltdown-tantrum and effectively acknowledges that Sturdy is a far, 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 far better admiral than him, and that the minute the situation has changed from anything other than a flat, calm, lovely view, Sturdy is absolutely going to hand him his backside on a platter. He knows this is going to happen. But he doesn't try and do anything about it. He doesn't try and invent some new tactic. He doesn't even ask around some of his subordinates for ideas. He doesn't make it a learning experience. Nothing. He just kind of sits there and goes, well, we're doomed. And sure enough, when the fog lifts, Sturdy has him dead to rights. And then Beatty just goes, okay, cool, exercise over. Nobody won. Which has taught nobody anything, except for some immediate observers, the fact that you're actually a terrible admiral from a, you know, grand strategy perspective. And to cap it all off, you've done this in front of guests. You know, this is supposed to be the mightiest navy in the world, and Beatty, as the head of the Grand Fleet, is supposed to be one of the best naval officers in the world at the time. And a certain Ernest King is watching all of this and going, huh, so this is supposedly the great and grand Royal Navy, a childish, you know, temper tantrum that has learned, given the fleet no new knowledge, and has just, you know, essentially thrown his toys out the pram and walked away. Yeah, suddenly Ernest King's estimation of the average British flag officer has gone plummeting down for some inexplicable reason. And that leads in part to all sorts of shenanigans down the line in World War II. So, you know, if you think of all the lives that were lost because of some of the friction between the Royal Navy and the US Navy, courtesy of Admiral King, you can actually trace back a lot of the blame to Beatty. Now, of course, yeah, King holding on to his Anglophobia for a couple of decades is kind of also on him, but he probably wouldn't have had it, or at least wouldn't have had it to that kind of degree, if it hadn't been for Beatty in the first place. Brendan Buersdorf asks, I don't think I've heard this question asked before. Was there anything the Austro-Hungarian fleet could have done better in World War One? Honestly, yeah, I think there was. The bombardment of Ancona and surrounding operations went relatively well for the Austro-Hungarians. And the thing is, after a little bit of back and forth, the Allies actually settled down to a strategy where they tried to contain the Austro-Hungarian Navy to the Adriatic. So they had the Otranto Barrage. But the thing is, that meant that to a limited degree, they kind of had free run of the Adriatic. But they never really sent out a mass force like they did at the beginning of the war. As you said, they kind of mostly sat in port, did limited deployments. Most of the stuff they sent out was small groups and, you know, small cruisers and destroyers. Now, obviously, sending out a big battle force is high risk, high reward. But given that you have the inherent advantage of literally a home field advantage, plus any heavy ships that you're potential enemies have are mostly based considerably further south, and you have a fairly significant land war going on the northern Italian border area. If I was in charge of the Austro-Hungarian Navy, I would be advocating quite hard for actually just taking the entire fleet. Now, granted, the Italian Mars boats and subs and so forth could be a fairly significant threat, but you know, that's why you concentrate the fleet. You have a bunch of escorts. And then what I would do is send some auxiliaries, maybe some second line destroyers, the odd cruiser or two, send them down slightly ahead of time towards the Otranto Barrage to keep an eye on things and keep the Allied fleets kind of looking in their direction. And then you sail everything else out deep in the night. Adriatic's not exactly that wide. Head over and at the very minimum, do a bunch more bombardment missions, because you're there, you're all, you know, prepared, ready, locked together, you know, hopefully got communication sorted out, and you will hopefully get notice if the Allied heavy units start moving up from the Otranto Barrage, at which point you can take a reading based on what's being reported. You know, is the Allied heavy force weaker than you, in which case, hey, you've just got a fleet battle on your terms. You know, you were ready for this, they weren't. Sail down, meet them, crush them. And if the Allied force is significantly stronger than you, or, you know, close enough to make it a fair fight, well, you're much closer to home and they're scrambling, so just go home. You've completed your mission, and worst comes to worst, the Allies are forced to move the Otranto Barrage much further up the Adriatic to prevent a repeat, which makes it much, much easier for you to attack with your own submarines, imported German submarines and destroyers and so forth. And if they don't move up, well, just repeat the exercise and blow up more bits of the Italian eastern coastline until they do send something that's worth fighting. But you know, they decided not to do that. But I think it certainly could have been a strategy that could have brought them some great benefits. I mean, yeah, sure, it could have potentially gone horribly wrong, but that's war for you. Greg Germain asks, in the time period between, say, 1600 and 1815, did European ship hull design from waterline to keel change very much? Was this the subject of academic study, or was it all very empirical? It did change a fair bit, but it wasn't a form of scientific or academic study as we would understand it today in the 21st century, but it also wasn't purely empirical, kind of, oh, well, that worked, this didn't work, therefore we will do this. There was a certain degree of that, because ultimately, you know, the theories of hydrodynamics that we use today, and even that were used in the 20th century and the late 19th century, they simply didn't exist. You know, you couldn't tank test a model because, well, Froude's tank testers for models didn't come about till the latter part of the 19th century. But what they did do was look at what worked and what didn't, and they would have hull models, very detailed to-scale hull models, because, of course, they'd have plans drawn up for ships that they were going to be building, and then those plans would be super-scaled in mold lofts to create the actual ship, but that meant you had your scale plans, which you could then create an exact scale model from. And that's why evacuating the models from Chatham during the Dutch raid on the Medway was so important, because those were essentially the embodied future of Royal Navy hull design at that point. It was essentially the equivalent of, you know, grabbing the hard drives out of the computers and running off with them today if your R&D section was under attack. And so, with physical models to examine as well as the actual ships, people would begin to put together theories and even basic formula on how to design hulls for stability for big ships of the line, more for speed for things like frigates, and for a kind of a mix between speed and stability for very specific ships, which were, you know, small ships of the line, large frigates, maybe even a large ship of the line if you wanted to make it really, really special. And so over the time period that you describe, 1600 to 1815, discounting the rather radical changes that were happening right at the very end of that period, you have things like hull length to beam ratios becoming somewhat longer. And of course, that requires a reprofiling of the hull lines, because the hull lines that work for a ship that's got a length to beam ratio of, say, 2.5 or 2.7 to 1, like you see here with Sovereign of the Seas, if you just stretch that to 3.5 to 1, which you might find on a 1805 era vessel, it's not going to work particularly well, and you are going to have to make changes. And you'd have lessons brought in from things like galleys and other Mediterranean vessels and other ships that various people encountered over time. And of course, you had a diversification of effort, because smaller ships in 1600 were just smaller ships, really. There wasn't a huge amount of thought put into them beyond the collected, accumulated wisdom thus far. Where the real work was being done was in the big ships, whether that be great frigates or great ships, or royal ships, whatever. Whereas by the late 1700s, early 1800s, there were very specific schools of thought on, this is what we want for a big ship of the line, this is what we want for our regular third-rate ships of the line, and what we want for a big frigate, you know, a big fifth-rate, perhaps even a fourth-rate, once super frigates start to be built, versus what we want for a sixth-rate, or what we want for a sloop or a brig. All of these hull forms, while to the outside eye they might all seem natural evolutions one from the other, they are actually very different hull forms. They reflect very, very different things in terms of length to breadth ratio, you know, how much height above the waterline do they have to support, where is the center of gravity and stability, all of this kind of thing. So there was an awful lot of study put in, and if you do, you know, happen to come across ship design books for the late 1700s, very, very early 1800s, you will find a number of, to our mind, fairly simple but still relatively well thought out formula for the basics of hull design, which is something that really doesn't exist much at all in the early 1600s. Now, as I said, a lot of it was based on empirical evidence, you know, trial and error, this works, this doesn't, refine this here, oh, that worked better, that didn't work quite as well. But as time went on, it was getting more and more into a, theoretically, according to my calculations, this should work, now let's see if it does, as opposed to earlier on when it was almost entirely dominated by, well, we built this before, therefore we will build this again with a few minor variations. Although, yeah, as I said, that kind of thing still did happen. Sam Signorelli asks, the Greenland air gap, or the mid-Atlantic air gap for the North Atlantic convoys, was there some reason why an airbase couldn't be set up in the southern portion of Greenland to cover that gap? There are three communities in the area, which were established and populated long before the war, and they should have been close enough to the convoy routes to provide air cover in the gap. There are a number of factors in play which mitigated, at least early on, against setting up an air base in Greenland. Firstly, the status of Greenland, which is, of course, technically part of Denmark, Denmark having been taken over by the Germans. Greenland was kind of standing alone as a little bit of a last remaining outpost of free Denmark, but therefore was also neutral. So in 39, 40, most of 41, it wasn't possible to do anything there because that would be to violate Greenland's neutrality. However, the US took a particular interest in the status of Greenland, understandably considering the location of Greenland relative to everywhere else, although the British were quite interested as well. And so when the US joined the war, Greenland wasn't that far behind. Now, of course, the other factor is what range is available on the aircraft that you have available. So you can see here, this is obviously dated mid-1942, map of the convoy routes, and it shows the air gap. Now, theoretically, you could try and fill this air gap with air bases in southern Greenland. However, if you look at the radius of aircraft, as shown here, going from Canada and Iceland and the UK, and you kind of interpose a similar radius over southern Greenland, it'll cover some of the mid-Atlantic air gap, but not a huge amount. Only some of the direct northern Atlantic convoys, and not all of them. And you would be contending with some pretty serious weather conditions to maintain that airbase, despite Greenland being called Greenland and Iceland being called Iceland. Really, it should be the other way around, but that's Vikings for you. But in any case, there was actually a couple of airbases established in southern Greenland, but by the time you had them significantly up and running, advancing aircraft technology also came into play. So, as I said, this is roughly what Allied air patrols could do in August 42. But if we switch to another map from 43, this is almost exactly a year later, and you'll see that although there's still no radius coming off of any airbase in Greenland, the majority of the HX, SC and ON convoy routes are now actually covered by the radius of aircraft basing themselves out of Iceland and out of Canada, simply because more aircraft and bigger aircraft with a longer range have been made available to Coastal Command and its mirror counterparts in Canada and the US and so forth. So between this and escort carriers, while there would be some limited patrols based out of southern Greenland, essentially by the time they were in a position to be able to theoretically offer a way of closing the mid-Atlantic air gap, the mid-Atlantic air gap had already been closed by aircraft based on pre-existing airfields and, of course, the introduction of escort carriers as well. And then when they looked at the situation, they realized, well, we do have these air bases in southern Greenland, but they are actually quite difficult airfields to fly in and out of because of the location, the geography, the weather, etc. And so it was mostly decided to continue using those air bases as stepping stones in the Atlantic ferry route for US aircraft heading to Europe, rather than make them major hubs of anti-submarine patrol, because it would essentially be more trouble than it was worth. You'd end up losing more aircraft to bad weather or to, you know, missed approaches and so forth, as compared to any utility you'd get out of it by the time that, as I said, these longer range aircraft are helping close the gap anyway. The Rogue Chief asks, what would you consider to be the best example of combat trolling, whereby a ship is captured by the enemy, then used by said enemy against its original owners to frustratingly annoying effectiveness? Well, there's a lot of potential candidates, but some of the ones that are, I think, in the spirit of trolling are some of the best uses of captured ships, like the whole HMS President USS Macedonian rivalry that the Royal and United States Navies kept going for quite a while on the North America station. They aren't really combat uses against the enemy, so in the context of this question, they don't count. I think, although it'd be hard-pressed to pick a specific one, I would say a strong candidate would probably be the Tonnant. As you can see here, this is Tonnant against Menarca at Trafalgar, because Tonnant was a big third rate, captured at the Battle of the Nile, one of the last ships, in fact, to strike its colours, but then brought into Royal Navy service. She's patched up and then sees action in multiple engagements, including, of course, the Battle of Trafalgar, where she captures the Algeciras. And Tonnant makes an absolute pain in the side of herself for the French, because she is in almost constant use from the moment she clears Dockyard again after having been repaired after the Nile until the end of the Napoleonic War. She's almost everywhere. Obviously, a lot of time fighting the French. She also spends a fair bit of time annoying the US during the War of 1812. She's one of the most heavily used Royal Navy third rates, and because of her slightly greater size compared to the average 74-gunner, she's made a flagship, and in a lot of operations, obviously not Trafalgar, and therefore sees a lot more action in that role than perhaps a lot of other ships would do. And so, yeah, in terms of overall effectiveness, she did far, far, far more service in terms of blockade duty, capturing various ships, supporting the capture of others, and so forth. She did a lot more of that for the Royal Navy than she ever did for the Marine Nationale. And, you know, if the Royal Navy had just built her from the keel up, she would be a really good investment. The fact that they got her, okay, not for free, they had to fight for her, but essentially for free compared to the cost of building her, it just made it all the sweeter. Rebel Skverl asks, do you happen to know when, where, and why the tradition have developed of smashing a bottle of alcohol against a ship when it's christened and launched? I don't know exactly when the tradition transferred over to smashing a bottle against the stem of the ship, but the general idea of doing so appears to have originated from around about the very end of the 1700s, early 1800s, essentially commensurate with when glass bottles of alcohol were somewhat accessible and not built like absolute tanks. Therefore, there was a reasonable chance you might actually be able to smash such a thing. But the general idea of something being spilled on a ship in order to christen it and give it luck as it went into the water, that goes back into, you know, ancient times. Back in the properly old ancient times, it would be a sacrifice to the gods, presumably the sea god or sea gods, if your culture happened to have one or more of those types of deities, to try and obviously mitigate against them sinking your ship immediately. And that kind of just carried on as culture developed, and then eventually you get to the time when, at least in Europe, the Catholic Church has pretty much taken over the religious monopoly, but they frown on the whole animal sacrifice or occasionally human sacrifice thing. So it gradually shifts from being a blood sacrifice over to, for a good chunk of actually the medieval and Renaissance period, wine. And it's not a wine bottle smashed against the stem of a ship. It's, according to at least one source, it would be that you would have a goblet of wine would be poured on the deck of the ship, not literally poured out on the deck, but you would be standing on the deck. Someone will fill a goblet with wine. The person in charge of the launch ceremony would take a drink, and then they would go to the four cardinal points of the ship and spill some wine at each of those points, say a prayer, and then something would be done with a goblet, whether that be thrown, whether it be given to an honoured guest or something like that. And that was actually the custom, or a variation on the custom, for a very long period of time. And you can kind of see where that's come from. You know, it's gone from a blood sacrifice and the blood being offered to the god of the sea and, you know, smeared on the ship, to something that looks very much like blood but isn't blood and therefore is theologically acceptable, and being spilled on the ship for luck. And then in the 18th century, it sort of transitions across to the take a bottle of something. It could be whiskey, wine, champagne, or with various other alcohols as appropriate to the region, and smash it against the side of the ship, or the stem of the ship, ideally. And that's kind of just developed from there. Nowadays, well, rather rapidly, I would say probably in the 19th century, various permutations to that tradition developed. So before, it would be kind of standing a little bit away from the ship because, well,
it wasn't necessarily too safe to be close to a ship that was about to launch, and just lobbing the thing. Unfortunately, that led to two problems. One would be occasionally the bottle wouldn't break because it wasn't thrown with enough enthusiasm, which would then be seen as a very bad omen. And separately, there were occasionally incidents in that kind of era when the bottle would be lobbed with, shall we say, more enthusiasm than accuracy. And there were a few cases where, you know, this big, heavy glass bottle of liquor or some other alcohol would go sailing past the intended target of the ceremony and go off into the crowd. And then some poor sap would end up with, you know, significant injuries from being hit by a ballistic bottle of alcohol. Although I suppose then he had a bottle of alcohol to help console him with the fact he'd just been smacked by it. So there you go. So nowadays, that's why you kind of tend to see them tied to something like a ribbon, so that, yes, you might take a swing and a miss, but if you do, it's just going to come back and you can try again rather than potentially beaning someone in the head. James Lovas asks, after Coronel, what would have happened if von Spee had tried to take his squadron through the newly opened Panama Canal? Nothing particularly good for poor old von Spee, because you would have had the North American West Indies squadron waiting for him. Now, that squadron did have a number of armoured and what would be termed at the time light armoured or light cruisers in its possession, a force somewhat stronger than the one that von Spee had faced at Coronel. But the really big elephant in the room wasn't that force, which in theory von Spee might have had a fighting chance against if he'd played his cards right. The much bigger elephant in the room was that, specifically in response to Coronel and because of it, the North American West Indies squadron had been reinforced by a battlecruiser. Now, of course, we know what two Invincible class did to von Spee at the Battle of the Falkland Islands, except this was not an Invincible class. The one that was sent to reinforce the West Indies, specifically against von Spee potentially coming through the Panama Canal, was Princess Royal. She's obviously faster, more heavily armed, and more heavily protected than an Invincible ever was. So if there was ever anything the phrase outside context problem applied to in relation to poor old von Spee's squadron, Princess Royal was pretty much it. She would have been able to demolish von Spee's squadron almost single-handed, let alone with the backup that she actually had. So yeah, it's probably overall for the best that von Spee didn't do that, because of course, the other thing is, transiting the Panama Canal is not a quick process. It's very easy to spot anything that is coming through. So if von Spee had taken his squadron through there, there would have been all the time in the world for the British to be waiting on the Caribbean side. And, you know, the Battle of Falkland Islands was bad enough for the Germans when they had an open sea to run into. Whereas in this situation, well, the British would just be waiting for them the minute the Germans cleared the locks. Robert Henry Ilston asks, are there any real-life Geordie LaForges or Scotties that you could name during the time period of the Channel, and maybe give us an example of their skills? Sadly, not immediately and easily. There are quite a number of engineers who would fit that kind of criteria, but for various reasons, when it comes to the historical accounts, you know, I can name you all sorts of incidents where the chief engineer and their staff performed those kind of Star Trek-like miracles. But usually, in those accounts, it's just described as the engineers, or the chief engineer, or the engineering staff, something like that. And to be fair, unlike Star Trek, when it comes to some rather significant disaster happening aboard a ship that then has to be patched up by the engineers, it usually, you know, for it to be big enough and bad enough to be mentioned in the first place, it usually means that it's big enough and bad enough that it needs the entire engineering team to fix. So it's not the kind of, oh yes, well, the chief engineer went and did this specific thing and that is what saved the ship. That very, very rarely happens. It'll usually be the chief engineer led a whole section of his staff in carrying out these 16 million different actions to stop the ship from sinking. And I mean, obviously, therefore, you know, you definitely get deserved recognition for leadership and identifying the problem and sending the right people to the right places. But it's not that they individually saved the ship. You know, they didn't plug every hole, they didn't reignite every boiler, they didn't reinitialize every pump, etc., etc. And so quite often hunting down the names of individuals responsible for those kinds of things can be much more difficult. So while unfortunately I can't just start rattling off names, it is perhaps inspiration for a video in the future. And that brings us to an end of this week's video. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Exactly in on an hour, and I hope to see you again in another video at some point soon. Bye for now.